was Sam Davis with In Your Company. Now you've got Sir and Miss with their fortnightly session of science they never told you about at school.
Welcome to another science show on Cambridge 105. In today's programme, we interview an archaeologist to learn how what might be classed as a part of history draws heavily on techniques we use in science. Also, we'll look at a listener's idea to fill bubble wrap with helium.
Plus, we tell you about some very interesting talks about town, and get ready for an interview after this bit of a tune.
This is The Science Show on Cambridge 105, the community radio in your city. It normally starts with a hello from me, Roger Frost.
And hello from me, Chris Creese, as we bring you 30 minutes of nifty science they never told us about in school, especially when it happens here in Cambridge.
With no more ado, we'll go straight on to hear today's guest, our first archaeologist on a show that's normally devoted to chemistry, physics and biology. Dr. John Creese is from the MacDonald Institute for archaeology here in Cambridge. I was frankly intrigued to know what his subject is about and to find out what we have in common. Archaeology is now popped up, and I noticed, on the Cambridge Science Festival, but it's not actually clear to everyone, especially even a scientist, what archaeology is. So what do you study?
Archaeology is really a huge field. It covers essentially the full range of human experience. So from the first members of the genus Homo, when they started using tools about 2.5 million years ago, right up to the recent past. So anything's fair game in archaeology. And so as a result, the kinds of questions that we ask range from hyper sort of scientific questions about ecology, evolution, to much more humanistic and social kinds of questions, such as about religious systems, belief systems, that sort of thing.
Most of us think that archaeologists dig underground. How true is that?
Fieldwork is a major part of what archaeologists do, but it's not the only thing. We need to go out and dig to collect information about past human lives. So yeah, most archaeologists have a field component, but many archaeologists also work in museums and places like that on collections that have been gathered by field work in the past. So these are archaeological objects, everyday things. Most of it is essentially garbage or trash from people's everyday lives, and it develops at resident sites. And archaeologists can go out and collect those objects, and we can do a whole lot with them. We can understand everything from, you know, what people ate to the kinds of beliefs that they may have had, and everything in between.
Okay. Well, if I look at this pen on this table here, it's a very cheap pen somebody's left behind. So I will assume that the person is perhaps a cheapskate and steals pens from shops. Right. So how accurate do you feel that are the sorts of things that archaeologists do? It can't be pure guesswork.
There is a kind of misconception that it's highly speculative and that we just sit around making stories up about what we find. But actually, we use a lot of hard science techniques to characterize the materials that things are made out of, to understand where they come from, for instance. And we use statistics to understand, in the case of your pens, what proportion of pens at a site are your sort of simple Bic pens, and how many people had a fancy fountain pen, rather. Mm-hmm. And then we can start to look at the kind of social difference between people on that site. When you have enough data, you can start to build up to these more complex questions like, what does this pen mean for the people who used them?
Give us some examples of the sorts of things that archaeologists might be dealing with.
Archaeologists try to understand how people lived in the past. So they ask initially very simple questions. What were the people on this site doing? What did they eat? How long were they at a site? Is this an individual household? Was it occupied for thousands of years? Is this a town, a city? All those sorts of questions are the first things that we asked when we try and build up a picture of what was going on, both at a site and then regionally as well. Then we start to ask questions about what the political organization might have been. Do we have a situation where we have multiple large centers with several thousand people interacting as some sort of polity, or do we have a much smaller scale of society? And we use ethnographic analogies and historical analogies to try and understand from contemporary cultural examples what was going on in the past.
Are there other kinds of archaeology? Are there branches of archaeology?
Absolutely. So there are many branches of archaeology. As I say, it's this very big tent discipline. So you have people who would brand themselves as archaeological scientists, and they study things like geoarchaeologists study site formation. So the way in which layers of sediments build up over time. And that's very important for understanding the chronology of a site. If you have something like a tell, which is these large mounds, town mounds essentially, in places like Turkey that build up over centuries of people living in one spot. You need to understand the processes, the amount of time that elapses between levels. That's just one example. Other branches take on things like looking at, for instance, artwork that might fall into a much more humanistic perspective of the human past. So people who look at rock art from the Paleolithic, for example, and try and understand the belief system that was behind it. So you can sort of picture many different types of archaeological practice between those. You have economic approaches that look at trade and exchange patterns within empires, such as the Roman Empire. So all these different types of questions come under the broad category of archaeology.
You would be at some point coming over to the science department to borrow some bits and pieces?
Yeah, we borrow a lot from various different scientific disciplines, and a lot of the techniques are now fully incorporated into the normal operations of archaeology. So, for instance, at the MacDonald Institute here at Cambridge, we have six different sort of specialized labs that look at different aspects of archaeological science, ranging from the geoarchaeology that I mentioned to bioarchaeology, which looks at people's interactions with plants and animals. Okay. So this is looking at reconstructing climates and climate change, past environments, but also the origins of agriculture. So how people initially started interacting with plants and animals that led to domestication of crops and various animals. Mm-hmm. Archaeogenetics is another interesting and relatively new branch. So this is looking at both fossil DNA and also the DNA of contemporary plants, animals, and humans to infer things like the movement of crops and humans over landscapes. So there's a project at Cambridge, for instance, that's analyzing the interaction or the exchange of different crops between China and Western Asia.
Wow. What are phytoliths?
Yeah, so under that category of bioarchaeology and the study of climate, one of the techniques that people use is the study of phytoliths. And this is kind of an interesting example of how science meets these wider archaeological questions. Phytoliths are small bits of silica that develop within plant cells.
Okay.
And unlike most of the plant will decay and be gone, but these little structures remain, and they remain in soil. They can also adhere to various types of artifacts. So you'll find them on actually teeth as well.
Oh.
So it can tell you about the types of plants that people were eating or the types of plants that they may have been grinding on a grinding stone, say. And we can recover those phytoliths and usually identify them to the broad family. So we could perhaps distinguish maize from beans. So then you can start to answer questions about, okay, what were people eating at this site? You can also use them to look at climatic change. So phytoliths also develop in layers in lake sediments, for instance. Mm-hmm. So by coring those sediments, then you can start to look at the plants that were deposited in those different layers. And if you can date those layers, then you can look at the change in the plants that were growing in that vicinity through time. So those are some of the techniques that we do in order to understand the wider environment surrounding a site and how that might have impacted the people that lived there.
So the way people live is kind of key to this? Have I misunderstood something about archaeology I should have learned a long time ago?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's a humanistic discipline. So we're not studying dinosaurs or anything totally unrelated to humans. It's broadly a social science. So we want to understand how human lives have changed since the beginning of humans on the Earth.
A lot of people would say that we've got pretty good at living. So my question is, what have we got to learn that will help us?
Yeah, that's an absolutely key question, I think, for archaeology to grapple with. You might think that we've gotten very good at living, and if you look around at all the quote-unquote advanced technologies that mm-hmm. we have today, we might sort of pat ourselves on the back. But we continuously are experiencing the same kind of problems and crises that people experienced in the past. So things like climate change, for instance, these kinds of fluctuations have happened before, and archaeology can study the way that various populations actually experienced those crises, when and how people were resilient and able to come through them, and the cases in which populations actually were decimated or, in fact, occasionally went extinct. In a way, we can take these cases as lessons to be applied to contemporary situations.
And who's listening to you?
There's a growing interest, a growing awareness of what archaeology does and the kind of answers that we can provide. And so more and more you'll see it in popular magazines, that sort of thing.
So John, tell us how you're incorporating this archaeology into your research.
Broadly, my research is interested in looking at how village formation affects social interactions. How do people cope with that process? So in many parts of the world, around the time when we get the first agriculture, the first crops being grown, we also have processes of sedentism. So people are settling down on the landscape. They're moving together and forming stable communities, larger villages. And that poses a lot of problems socially. How do people learn to get along, essentially? And when you're living in small hunter-gatherer bands, a lot of those social pressures associated with living in larger groups aren't there. People can simply walk away if they don't want to live together. So it turns out to be kind of a crucible of culture change in many parts of the world in this critical early village period. So I'm really interested in what happens in social organization. One of the ways that I'm doing that, I work in Eastern North America on a Native American society, the Iroquoian peoples. And there we have a very rapid period between about 1000 AD and 1500 AD in which we have this sedentarization or village formation process, and the villages get rapidly much, much larger. And so people are potentially grappling with these scalar issues at that time. And one of the things that we see in terms of the archaeology in this period is that the material culture begins to change very rapidly. So by this, I'm referring to things like pottery and smoking pipes. So clay smoking pipes were initially quite a rare object on these sites. But in the period that I'm looking at, around 1400, they suddenly kind of explode in popularity. And they also become incredibly diverse. And they're exchanged over a wider Eastern North American region. We know from the early contact period history that the exchange of smoking pipes is really important in solidifying trade relations between various political groups, so different Iroquoian tribes creating alliances and that sort of thing through the exchange of various types of goods. I'm quite interested in the exchange of pipes and understanding how pipe exchange was linked in with this process of creating tribal identities, essentially, and managing kind of political relations between them. One of the cool techniques that we can use to understand those trade relations is to actually look at what's called the fabric of the ceramic pipe. Okay. So this is essentially using a technique called laser ablation, ICP-MS, which is a really fancy term for zapping your pottery pipe with a laser, and measuring the elemental composition of it. Essentially, that allows us to look at the sources of raw material, the clay that was used to make the pipe. And then we can identify the kind of sources for different pipes in the region. So if you're looking at a site, you can see, okay, some of these pipes were obtained from this group over here. Right. Some were made locally. And so we can start to put together a picture of how these different local polities are interacting through the trade.
That's me. So you're not outsourcing on this analysis. It's now in-house.
In my case, I'm doing it actually at the Field Museum in Chicago. So they basically have a dedicated machine and lab set up to do that.
Oh, I see. Yeah. How does archaeology become scientific and, should we say, earn its place at the Cambridge Science Festival?
Right. Great question.
As if you're begging.
Yeah. So although it has this kind of humanistic slant to it, it's always also been closely aligned to the natural sciences. So, for instance, in the 19th century, early archaeologists were doing things directly comparable to natural history. They're collecting artifacts and placing them in sort of evolutionary sequences to try and understand technological change. And that was kind of the early emphasis there. And so actually it has had this link to natural history and the natural sciences ever since the beginnings. In the 1960s, there was a concerted effort to rebrand archaeology as explicitly a science, a science of humankind, essentially. And so at that point, especially in the United States, a number of people emphasized human ecology approaches to archaeology. So especially understanding how things like climate change influenced culture over time. More recently, this has been seen as just one part of the overall project of science. But since the 1960s, we've had all these hard science methods come in, like radiocarbon dating and things like laser ablation, ICP-MS, and other methods to characterize materials. And so all these methods then allow us to build up those little questions about what people ate and how they lived, to answer those larger questions about how social groups can change and the ways in which culture and environment interact.
Can you tell me how archaeology is different from history?
Oh, that's a great question. You could see there are two ways to think about that. One is that archaeology is a form of history, but it uses material evidence rather than texts. That would be the classical definition. So history relies on written documents to tell the story of human past, and archaeology is all about artifacts and what we can actually find in the world on the ground. So just different sources of evidence, but they're both forms of history. In the United States and Canada, the tradition is a little bit different because archaeology is generally subsumed within anthropology. And so seen more as a science of how human culture operates in the past and more recently. So it's a little bit of a different twist. But I think in general, most archaeologists are happy with being seen as an historical science anyway. Anthropology is generally the study of human cultures and societies in the contemporary world. So looking at both the West and also non-Western cultures, basically whatever's happening in the world today and the recent historical past, but not relying heavily on deeper historical information. So that's the difference between social anthropology and archaeology. We go deep time because we have this record that allows us to do that.
Excellent. People may be interested in this, but they've had very little introduction to it at school. What got you interested in archaeology?
I think it was doing a science fair project. So I don't know if they do this here, but in Canada, we have science fair projects. It was maybe a little bit random, but I chose archaeology and then I started reading about it. And I discovered ancient Egypt and it's just really fascinating, the amazing finds that were made there. And that got me thinking about the overall scope of human history and how deep it is. And so I think that was the bug that bit me, and it's been with me ever since.
So what kind of archaeological science happens here in Cambridge?
almost all kinds of archaeological science. We have six different dedicated labs, and they range from geoarchaeology, or the study of how sites form, bioarchaeology, which is the study of interaction of humans with plants and animals, archaeogenetics, which is studying DNA and the transfer of genetics over space and time, zooarchaeology, which is the study of animal remains, so we can look at diet and things like that, and also isotopes. So these are chemical isotopes, things like nitrogen and oxygen, and they can help us understand all sorts of questions about, for instance, where a person may have been born and consumed food in their early years, and then if they move to another place and die, then we can find their place of origin based on those isotopes. So movements, diet, the environment, all these kinds of things.
Goodness me. Thank you, John.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
This week we had a question from Stuart. Stuart writes anonymously, has anyone ever gone away and explored the science behind the idea of putting helium in bubble wrap to reduce postage costs? What a great idea.
Yes, great question, Stuart. It's a fun idea, but in practice it would have a few serious challenges. So let's talk about those. Because helium is the second lightest element and it's widely available for pretty reasonable prices, I can see why you thought of using it to float your mail. Funnily enough, the low price of helium is actually a problem because it's so widely used that we may run out of it in 30 years. Can you believe that, Roger?
Mm-hmm.
That's quite soon. And helium was created long ago by the radioactive decay of thorium and uranium, which makes it a non-renewable resource. And here on Earth, helium is a very rare gas, relatively, despite being the most widely used of all the inert gases.
Okay. But you do see helium is useful everywhere. It's used to not just float party balloons, it's used in arc welding, used in diving, growing silicon crystals. It's needed as a coolant in the hospital MRI scanner. I even have my own personal supply just for making weird phone calls and helping me talk in a funny voice.
Do you now?
Well, it's just what you need when you answer sales calls from people selling you hearing aids, or you could use it to apply to King's College Choir, or you could use it to book some singing lessons with your squeaky voice.
Does it make you a nice soprano?
It may do. But you've reminded me that when we were kids, we bought helium-filled balloons at the fairground. We used to use it to make our voices squeaky. And we kept going back to this guy, talking in our squeaky voices and laughing hysterically. But he soon put a stop to it,
aww,
thinking we were getting some kind of a high. We weren't. We were just laughing uncontrollably.
Well, no wonder we're running out of it so fast, Roger. You guys sucking it all up. But getting back to Stuart's idea to use helium to make parcels lighter and cheaper, the point is that even though helium is priced pretty low, the expense of using it may still be greater than the original cost of the postage.
Good point. I think another challenge to the idea would be that regular bubble wrap isn't helium typed. Just like a helium balloon, it deflates as the helium diffuses out through the plastic. So we'd need some better material with holes that were too tiny for helium to get through.
A good point, Roger. And another downside I see is that a package with helium sealed inside can explode if exposed to heat. So surprise, postman! Actually, not a very nice surprise at all.
Well, I'm looking at the material safety data sheet for helium. It's easy to find these things. You can just look them up. And they tell you of all the hazards of something, including the point that inhaling too much helium can land you in a coma, amongst other things. So
yikes.
Filling your parcel with helium can do far worse than give you funny voices. I think I'll pause on making those prank telephone calls.
Good call, Roger. I think it would also be difficult to supply enough helium to float your parcel and reduce its weight. It's the same reason why I was disappointed as a kid when that handful of helium balloons just didn't levitate me. Plus, I think some shipping companies charge by cubic weight now, so having a bigger box to include more helium wrap would just drive the shipping price up.
Oh, well. So, Stuart, a brilliant question, but we've completely shot the thing to pieces.
But you could write to the TV show Mythbusters to encourage them to try it out and work out a solution.
But thanks for writing to us first.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
My co-host Chris seems to have popped out, so it falls to me to tell you what events are coming up in Cambridge. On Wednesday, the 15th of May, at 6 o'clock, there's a Science and Society event where you can hear about advances in scientific research and discuss how this work impacts on society. Called From Habit to Addiction, A Slippery Slope, there are speakers from King's College London and Cambridge, UK. This seminar-type event is being held by the European Bioinformatics Institute, but it's held in the centre of town. So on Wednesday the 15th of May at 6 o'clock, go to the Cambridge Union Society on Bridge Street. You can follow the event on Twitter at #SciSoc. Overlapping that, there's another mega event, a 3-day Cambridge Science Festival, happening in 3 pubs in town starting on Tuesday the 14th of May. Called A Pint of Science, a lot of top scientists will be swapping their lecture room venues to give a talk in the pub. It's best I point you to the website for the details. It's www.pintofscience.com, and here you'll get all the details of 9 connected events and be able to book your place. It's free. To get the programme in a nutshell for you, at the Portland Arms in Chesterton Road, the theme is the brain. And on the Tuesday evening, you'll hear about research into drug addiction and ways to prevent relapse. Another speaker, Dr. Karen Ursch, will tell you that although cocaine is one of the most addictive drugs, not everybody who uses cocaine becomes addicted to it. She'll talk about her research to understand why some people become addicted to drugs and others don't. Dr. Ursch, by the way, will appear on the next Science Show on Cambridge 105. On the Thursday, the talks focus on the efficacy of treatments for psychiatric conditions such as CBT and drug therapy. Or you could go to the Panton Arms in Panton Street and find the theme there is the body. On Tuesday the 14th, for example, you'll hear the remarkable success story of the HPV vaccine. HPV, or the Human Papillomavirus, is a common factor in about 5% of human cancers. You can also hear how the ability of intestinal parasites, which manipulate our immune system, turns out to be of great benefit. It appears that intestinal parasites can lessen and even prevent the onset of diabetes. At the Avery Pub in Regent Street, biotechnology is the topic. On the Tuesday, you'll hear about stem cells, what they are, and how we can now generate them in the lab. The talk describes how stem cell research helps to develop new diagnostic tools and therapies. Here on the Wednesday, there's a talk called Things You Don't Know You Could Do With Your Mobile Phone. Gosh! On the Thursday, you'll hear how we can make microorganisms provide us with a more environmentally friendly way to make the chemicals we need, such as plastics. And that, in turn, would reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. Similarly, another scientist will tell how algae, which are fast-growing aquatic plants, might be used to make biodiesel to fuel cars. It's early days yet, as we've still to meet the challenge to scale up production to make this a really useful, sustainable source of energy. Now, overall, this event happens in 3 days with 9 events in 3 pubs. The dates are Tuesday the 14th, Wednesday the 15th, and Thursday the 16th of May. All start at 7 o'clock. The website again is www.pintofscience.com. And don't forget that if you particularly want to hear about drug addiction, go to the Cambridge Union Society at 6 p.m. on Tuesday the 14th of May. And go to What's On in Cambridge University to find more details.
And what promises to be a very popular talk on Tuesday, 7th of May, there's A Slice of Raspberry Pi, a talk about a powerful computer you can now buy in the shops. And it looks like a piece of circuit board rather than a system box. And you'll need to book this right now, and be sure to go along Tuesday, 7th of May at 7 p.m. at the Institute of Continuing Education in Mattingly Hall. For more information, go to the University Talks and What's On websites, and we'll post links to those on our podcast page.
And that's pretty much all for today's Science Show on Cambridge 105. In a few days' time, you can hear a podcast recording of the show at the website www.cambridge105.fm.
And you can now pick up our podcasts on iTunes. Just search for 105 Science. Our next live show on Cambridge 105 will be in 2 weeks.
And if you want a reminder of that, follow us on Twitter at 105science. Meanwhile, if you have a science event to promote or a question to inundate us with, you can email us on science@cambridge105.fm.
And that leaves us to say many thanks, and bye from me, Chris Creese.
And bye from me, Roger Frost.